Remember the feeling of rushing home from school, tossing your backpack on the floor, and turning on the TV just in time for the afternoon block of cartoons? Way back when life was all about schoolyard rivalries and making it home before the streetlights came on? Well, what if those Saturday morning vibes collided with an action-packed sci-fi adventure? In the new comic, The Ruth Avenue Raiders, the best, and let's be honest, the cockiest elementary school football team on Ruth Ave is about to face a defensive line unlike anything they've ever seen. We're talking interdimensional robots from Sector 7. When these kids are challenged to a match where the stakes are way higher than just bragging rights, they realize their old playbook won't save them. It's a hilarious, action-packed story about friendship, teamwork, and learning to step out of your comfort zone, all before the sun goes down. If you know a young reader looking for a new graphic novel, or if you grew up on the heart of Hey Arnold, the playground politics of Recess, or the what-could-go-wrong energy of Dexter's Lab, this is the book you've been waiting for. It's The Sandlot Meets Transformers, created by Mad Cave Studios Talent Search winner Damian Becton and artist Marina Otegua Ruiz. The Ruth Avenue Raiders is now live on Kickstarter, and you do not want to miss the kickoff. Head over to www.ruthavenueraiders.com right now to secure your copy of The Ruth Avenue Raiders, only available until June 24th. By joining the squad early, you'll stay in the loop and get access to exclusive early bird rewards and updates that won't be available anywhere else. That's www.ruthavenueraiders.com. Help us bring this 90s-inspired adventure to life. Winner go Chrome.
Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Alex in partnership with CoverPrice.com, the ultimate comic book resource, highlighting a book from CoverPrice's weekly top 10 report for the week ending June 15th. These are the comics collectors chased the hardest last week, driving demand and pushing prices across the aftermarket. This week's highlight, Avengers Armageddon number 1, which came bagged with an already existing but still pretty neat Magic the Gathering Warstorm Surge card. While it's extremely difficult to play Magic the Gathering with one card, the Ryan Stegman cover for the kickoff of the event, which features Wolverine and Iron Man trying to restrain the Red Hulk from probably smushing Spider-Man into bug guts, has hit $24 for a near-mint copy. Hey, that could buy you a whole deck of Magic cards. That's easier to play. That was a highlight from CoverPrice's weekly top 10 report. Want to learn what your collection is worth right now? CoverPrice.com does all the hard work for you, tracking aftermarket sales for both raw and slab comics. CoverPrice.com lets you know what your comics are actually selling for. Interested in weekly new releases, FOCs, trending comic lists, and a ton of other great content? CoverPrice has you covered. Visit CoverPrice.com/comicbookclub today to get 1 month of CoverPrice for just $1. That's CoverPrice.com/comicbookclub. What's up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
And on The Stack, we talk about a bunch of books that have come out this week. Comic books, to be precise.
Yes.
So let's get into it, because it is a big week in the comic book industry. Kicking it off with Absolute Batman, number 21 from DC Comics, written by Scott Snyder, art by Nick Jurgoda. Lots of stuff going on in this issue, as the Robins are coming directly for Batman. Meanwhile, the quote-unquote villains, Two-Face, Penguin, Riddler, Killer Croc, are all dealing with the death of Jim Gordon a couple of issues back, as is Barbara Gordon. And there's a bunch of other things going on as well. This is the biggest series in comic books right now. But how are you feeling about it? How are you feeling about this issue? How are you feeling about this book?
I mean, it's really settled in. I like this issue because there's like multiple trains running. I like the flip of the Robins coming after Bruce. I like that they're sort of bad guys. We get a reveal in this issue that the leader of the Robins knows Alfred in a way that is like going to be something, I think. Like, all the little like web connecting threads are coming into focus. The rogues being like misfits, but not bad. They're like, ugh, we're monsters now. Should we be evil? But they're actually being a little bit vigilantes in this. They're sort of trying to do good in monstrous ways, which I think is just another, like, Scott's doing such a Jacob's Ladder with his Absolute book. It was like, everything's extreme. Some things are flipped on their heads. Some things are, like, a distorted version of what you already know. And to come at it from those multiple POVs rather than just being like, it's the mirror image of Batman or whatever the more simplistic version of this would be. The more, it's like everything's a little more shitty. He's able to surprise us in every little pocket of the story.
It's interesting you feel that way. I, of course, like this, Nick Dragotta's art is always phenomenal. I don't know how he fits so many panels and so many different panels on every page. I do like all of the individual characters. I think I said this with the last issue as well, but maybe I just need to be used to this new rhythm. But I miss the focus of the first couple of arcs. Like, we had Black Mask for the first couple of issues, and there were other things running under the surface and in the background, but that's what that was. And then we had, you know, I think it was the two-parter of Mr. Freeze or whatever, and that's fine. Yeah. Then we had Babe. Then we had Poison Ivy. And now we have, like, 15 things going on at the same time when I feel like this could have just been several issues of him taking on the Robins, or it's supposed to be the Scarecrow arc, and Scarecrow doesn't even show up here. We even introduce another villain at the end of this issue, who we got some hints of before, and it seems like they're going to be entering the mix. So it's starting to feel a little messy to me in a way, where I think it can get back on track. Maybe they just feel like, okay, we got to set up this stuff because there's things coming probably in issue 25, I would throw out there, that they want to make sure are set up. I like all the individual things, but I feel like we're starting to get like snapshots in the life of Absolute Batman rather than these like balls to the wall epics that we got at the beginning.
Well, I would also argue you're missing the focus on Bruce Wayne. Bruce Wayne is definitely something other characters are observing in this issue rather than the real point of view character that we've had for most of the run. But I don't know. These elements were in the mix. They were just a little closer to Bruce. Mm-hmm. And now they're sort of like little baby Robins. They've flown the nest a little bit, Alex, and they're away from Bruce. And maybe you're missing your pal Bruce because you're such a Batman freak. You can't even enjoy a Batman book that talks about other characters.
That may actually be it, that devoting himself to being Batman full-time, there's these other things that are filling the cracks. Like, spoiler here, but they already talked about it at HeroesCon this past weekend, and we kind of knew this was going to happen anyway. Barbara Gordon is going to become the Bat, and not exactly be like, I'm best friends with Batman, but be slightly on his side versus the Robins. So we are getting these different forces in Gotham City filling the hole that not Batman left, but Bruce Wayne left, which is interesting. And again, all of the ideas are interesting. There was this promise at the beginning of the Scarecrow arc. I thought that first scene where he comes out of the cornfield and kills those two dudes was so strong. The scene with Scarecrow again and Joe Chill, same sort of thing, but he's more this outside force versus like the main operating principle of what we're saying over the course here. So I don't know,
you're
man.
You're going to get your Scarecrow.
Yeah.
The thing with these guys, though,
you're going to get my Scarecrow and his little dog, too.
I'm going to get your Scarecrow. That's a threat I'm always using. The thing is, like, these guys are masters at the craft. So, like, they can't just keep telling, you know, 3-4-issue arcs where it's like, okay, insert the next villain and Batman will find a way to defeat him.
Sure.
They're adding the complexity to it so they can get to something that is bigger than the sum of its parts.
No, I hear you, but I want to throw out something that actually my son said to me the other day about this that really struck me.
You're really setting up he's going to take your spot on this podcast. All you talk about is your son's comic.
It's going to happen eventually. Our children will rise up and continue this podcast.
They'll kill us.
And wear our skin. No, he was saying that he felt like, obviously, this title is very manga-focused, and that's what you have in manga, is you have one villain for multiple parts, potentially multiple volumes, then they take care of the villain, and then they move on to the next villain. And that's what you got at the beginning, and now we're shaking that up a little bit, and it feels a little less manga-esque and a more American comics-esque in the rhythm of what they're doing. The rhythm of the night, if you will. The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
The rhythm of the Dark Knight. Took me a while.
I believe in the rhythm of the Dark Knight.
Anyway, why don't we move on to another big one, Amazing Spider-Man number 31 from Marvel, written by Joe Kelly, art by Patrick Gleason. This is something they've been teasing very heavily for a while. It's called The Talk. We found out last issue that Aunt May had a secret baby, and this issue we find out how that secret baby came to be. And I was very shocked because I didn't know how babies were made, and they got very graphic.
Yeah. If you're not reading this comic and that's a selling point for you, you will be disappointed if you're expecting to see Uncle Ben and Aunt May sexy that Alex seems to have been jonesing for quite some time.
You got
to
draw your own in the middle, so, you know. Anyway, we finally do get this talk. It's a very dramatic issue, but it's also cross-cut with Spider-Man entering a secret villain auction that's run by the Vulture, who now has a very long nose. What do you think about this one, Justin?
It's an interesting structure, I find. They tell this very heavy emotional story about, like you're saying, in gripping detail about Aunt May and Uncle Ben and how they struggled to get pregnant. Got pregnant and then lost the baby, and then a grown up is here, and we get that story. We don't get any resolution on what's going on and what's going to happen, which I thought was cool. And then it's intercut with this very boisterous, very, I don't mean this in a negative way, but like a boilerplate Spider-Man fight. He's just like kicking a bunch of ass, and I think, like, why do you think that was the way to tell this? Because it'd be too heavy, so it was like shaking it up, or is there
I think
larger
that was
idea?
Part of it, and it was also showing how Spider-Man is dealing with this, because so much of the focus is on Aunt May. It gives us, presumably this is taking place after they've already had the talk, and he has to blow off some steam by fighting all of these villains. And
by fighting an old man? That's how I blow off steam.
Yeah, exactly. I will say I really like the concept. The concept of it is it's an auction, but the way they auction off the stuff is the villains fight in a ring and whoever wins gets the item, which I thought was pretty neat. I'm sick and tired of like the same old villain auctions where it is a straightforward auction. This was a very fun riff on it. Do you think having this detracted at all from the Aunt May part? Because that's something that I was wrestling with a little bit.
I mean, it definitely, it made for just like a tonal, such a big tonal mismatch, but it's so intentional that I can't really, it's not like it was a whoops, I've messed up the tones here.
No.
So, and knowing that it's intentional, I sort of like it. It makes me, it fixes my emotions on both sides, and truly is like a palate cleanser for the heavy emotionality of the AMA story. I wish I got to read it all at once. Like, I want to see the resolution of the fight or something here. That was my biggest problem.
I was just mainly very surprised that they... I don't know. I was expecting something like... wasn't the issue in Ultimate Spider-Man where Mary Jane and Peter talk about him being Spider-Man called The Talk as well? So I was expecting something like that, where it's one issue and it's just a conversation. Maybe there was a talk about that talk and how they didn't want to do exactly the same thing again. But I feel like this would have been a little stronger if it just took you into Aunt May's perspective, focused on that, kept it on that, and that was the issue. You know,
I like that they took a swing to shake it up.
All right.
I just want the next issue immediately.
We're just not agreeing on anything today. Let's see if we can...
0 for 2, Alex.
Come to a concordance on this one. Concrete, Stars Over Sand, number 1 from Dark Horse Comics by Paul Chadwick. After 20 years, Paul Chadwick is back on Concrete. He talks about this a little bit in the back, but this is actually an idea that he's had percolating since, I think he said 1996, basically.
From a trip he took in 1996 to where
and this picks right up after the last Concrete story, which I was not expecting at all. If you don't know, Concrete is a guy who was kidnapped by aliens and put into this enormous concrete-esque body. Mostly he uses it to wander around and think about things most of the time. He is driving through the desert with his two friends / co-workers, whatever you call them, when
Maureen.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some other stuff going on there, I guess.
Now you're so bashful about this.
I don't know. Anyway, they end up in the desert, and then some other stuff happens by the end of this issue that sends Concrete on a new adventure. Quote unquote, this is phenomenal. Like, this so is good. Great.
We're fully in the bag as Concrete fans, but the fact that it picks up, I thought it was going to be like a standalone. Mm-hmm. You know, story. The fact that it picks up on the continuity incredibly hard, I thought is great. While putting Concrete, the tone is the same. The characters are still so internal. We get to hear their thoughts, what they're struggling with individually. And Concrete, like you say, that there's action, and there's certainly action in this. And the art is also fantastic from Paul Chadwick. But the action of this story that is setting up the rest of this arc is Concrete, and this is a spoiler. Concrete has been struck by lightning and mm-hmm. is stuck laying down in the sand.
Yes.
So,
which is such a Concrete plot, too, that it's not like he got struck by lightning and he gets electrical powers. It's like, nope, he's just going to keep sinking onto the bottom of that sand.
He's laying down so hard.
Yes. Oh, and I should have mentioned, it is way too late, three titles in, but spoiler warning for everything that we're talking about here in the stack. The thing that I was really impressed by, and maybe I got this wrong, but like he updated it anyway. Like, even though it's 20 years later, there's some talk of cell phones, if I recall, in the issue. So it doesn't take place in 1996. It takes place in 2026, but there's no time dash or anything like that. It's just let's keep going.
I think that's a great choice. It's very like deftly done. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me of the previous arc, which is when Concrete essentially had a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that it happened is he the last arc and maybe last two arcs of this from so long ago were about him falling in love with his scientist coworker, Maureen, and not knowing how sex or attraction work, feeling like he could never be loved by her. But then she does, and they have a sexual encounter, and then his alien body makes a baby.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Which I was like, when I read that, I was like, that's awesome. Like, it's so wild and then, but so justified. And it's very sexual when it's used to scene.
Yes. I have such a distinct memory of reading Concrete. I think it was on like tour with my sketch comedy group, and I got to that volume and I was reading it in the back of a van while we were traveling. And I got so overheated and uncomfortable when I was doing, because like
it's called hot. Turned on, Alex.
Yeah, first time I experienced that. Thank you for letting me know. I was very like, oh my god, this is way hotter than I thought it was gonna be.
Exactly. And then, but that, and that story being picked up here, I'm like very, I'm so back there mentally where I'm like, what's going to go on with this relationship? His son almost died because the body just made this baby, and they're dealing with that. And then the main action here, he has to write a speech for some public remarks he's doing, and he gets struck by lightning. It's just wild. No other comic has that story.
It's great. And it's beautiful as well. Like, absolutely gorgeous. It's in color as well, which is pretty exciting. A lot of the other stuff, at least that I've read, is black and white. So great. This is great. I highly recommend reading the rest of Concrete first before you get here. But it's just a beautiful book. I'm glad it exists. Absolute Green Arrow, number 2 from DC Comics, written by Pornsack Pichichot, art by Raphael Albuquerque. We are following Dinah Lance as she investigates a Green Arrow killer who is going after billionaires who have done wrong. She investigates two of the suspects this issue, leading to another death by the end here of a character that I did not expect at all to die.
No.
Justin, you called this one out on the show. What'd you think about issue 2?
Great. Like, still pushing the story forward, like, quickly. Like, no holds barred. The character that dies, I was like, they get shot with an arrow. And I'm like, oh, okay, that should be fine. And I was like, oh, no, that killed that character.
Yeah.
I was like, it was not a real core wound, but
yeah.
surprising. So that, like, that's catching me off guard. It remains topical, and, like, there's no better takedown of the billionaire class in comics right now than the absolute Green Arrow.
There's an exchange that happens in here. They have flashbacks to Oliver Queen, who died in the Absolute Evil special. And this issue, we're introduced to Mia Dearden, who is a genius coder who he hires and works with on his app. His partner, Jubal Slade, who he's known since college, was basically Epstein. Like, that's essentially the standard of this universe and has already been killed. But in this flashback, the conversation that he has with Mia, where Mia's like, he's raping 14-year-olds. And he's like, oh, I don't think Jubal would do that. I don't know. I'll have a talk with him. And it is this boys club mentality of like, no, but I know him. You hear it all the time on every level, particularly like Hollywood. You hear people talking about like, you know, but Kevin Spacey, he's a really beautiful actor.
Yeah.
Things like that. Or like, but Brett Ratner, I don't know. He directed the Rush Hour movies. Sure, I'll work with him. Like all of these people on different levels who are horrible abusers. And people make excuses for them because they know them or they worked with them or they never saw things happen themselves. And we talked to the team about this where they were like, I'm shocked we got away with this. Reading the first issue, I was like, yeah, I mean, you know, this is pretty violent, but I feel like you could have gotten away with this. This one is the one where it really starts to push it, I think, even harder.
Well, especially that's the character is doing this is Green Arrow, is Oliver Queen before he dies. So it's like, it's not even just a character that will emerge as a villain later. It's the hero, ostensibly, of this book, even though he's dead. And then the rug pull later of, like, the investigation, the character that she finds, like, oh, that's the killer. And it's like, nope, he's dead. He died. He was killed. So, like, that mystery, the unfolding nature of that mystery is really, really done well as well.
Spider-Man, The Long Way Home, number one for Marvel, written by Jonathan Hickman, art by Adam Kubert. This is the first book of, I believe, two that are basically teeing up Spider-Man Brand New Day, but also not doing it at all. Here we've got Hickman and Kubert mixing Spider-Man, the Hulk, and Punisher, three characters that are going to be in that movie. But again, has nothing to do with the movie. It is about the Punisher being sent on a mission to the jungle where he discovers a cosmic cube. Hulk is also after the cosmic cube. And by the end of the issue, Spider-Man is recruited to go after it as well. This is very much Hickman in his Wolverine revenge mode versus anything else. What'd you think about this?
I mean, I like the story. If you didn't know that this was vaguely tied in, I'm assuming vaguely tied into the movie, it would feel like Jonathan Hickman reached his hand into a Marvel bag and was like, oh, I got Spider-Man, Hulk, Punisher, and Cosmic Cube.
Yep.
And I guess I'll write a story about those things. Feels very random, but it's good. I like the characters, especially the way that the Cosmic Cube is working once the heroes or the soldiers get their hands on it. I'm like, oh, man, I haven't seen it done this way in a while. Very good. The weirdest part of it is that Spider-Man shows up.
Yes. Even he is like, why am I here?
Me?
What's going on? You really want me? It's fun. Wolverine Revenge was also fun. I don't think it's like a major work of Hickman's or anything like that. But as a weird ride, I certainly enjoyed this. I also liked, because this is out of continuity, you've got Punisher is going by the codename Punisher, and he has a little painted skull on his face instead of on his chest. Yeah. And I was like, oh, that's cool. I like that.
But a little shout out to the art as well. There's a great just two-page Hulk moment in this that is awesome. A lot of great, like, classic Marvel fodder, like AIM and Hydra, people getting just absolutely wrecked. Like, lots of like here, I think.
Yeah. The Trillion Dollar Kid, number one, the life story of Elon Musk from Ghost Machine and Image Comics, written by Jeff Johns, Peter J. Tobassi, and Francis Manapul, art by Stefano Simeone. This actually has nothing to do with Elon Musk, but is...
The timing.
It's incredible. Good for them. They're going to sell so many issues because of that. Anyway,
people are crazy for trillionaires.
They love it. Everybody loves it and feels good about it. And ultimately, it's good for society, is what I think, you know?
You're talking about this comic, of course.
Yeah, of course. This is a big plus, this comic. This is part of the Unbelievables, which used to be the Family Odysseys universe that also includes Hornsby and Halo and the Rockefellers. Here we're getting the origin, the first kid trillionaire in this universe who decides to go on a journey to explore the Unbelievables for a reason that becomes apparent by the end of the issue. Now, Justin, you've been asking, why are we doing this, even though you've been enjoying the Zero issues they've been putting out. Now that you know why they're doing this, how do you feel about it?
Well, I mean, this issue really, like, establishes this character, the Trillion Dollar Kid. We get origin. I was like, interesting, Band-Aid sales is what really pushed this kid into the trillionaire
spot. Yeah. I mean, everybody uses Band-Aids.
That's true. Good thinking. And then we get the complication, and then we get, at the end of it, to sort of the idea of what the Unbelievables are. And if I'm getting this correct, the Unbelievables are, like, magical holiday creatures, like Santa Claus, that live in a town?
I mean, that's one type of Unbelievables. It's just seems to be a capsule for whatever weird idea that they have, that they want to put it out in the world and maybe do a series off of, is the thing.
Yeah. I mean, wait, are you saying the Unbelievables is every one?
Yeah, it's every one of those things. It's the... There's a town where holiday creatures live. There's a genie who escaped her bottle. There's a monster band. There's Rockefellers, Hornsby and Halo, etc.
Yeah, and we get a tip into that. But it's just funny to, in this like very straightforward introduction of the Trillion Dollar Kid and sort of the drama around it, I was like, oh, I really like this. And then they're like, well, you know what else you like is everything. It's just like, it's like having a big plate, having a great, like, considered meal, tasting menu. And then they drop the last course, and it's like a stack of every candy. And they're like, you can't leave until you finish it.
To take a little bit of a step back, and we'll see how this turns out. It could be totally fine. But I'm a little weirded out that we're going to get the first issue of this title, and then it's continued in Hornsby and Halo, and then the Rockefellers before it comes back to that. That's weird to me. That has the potential to be confusing to read if you go from Trillion Dollar Kid number one to Trillion Dollar Kid number two. The other thing is...
But that's a classic crossover. That's the old-fashioned way of doing a crossover.
With the first issue?
I mean, less so with the first issue, yes, but that's the, like, that's how a lot of crossovers used to be, where it's like...
Yeah, no, I don't have a problem with that. I'm saying that, like, I think the status quo and the mystery here is interesting. This is an interesting character. There's good mystery. He has turned his town almost literally at points into Wonka Land, among other things. So, like, I want to see that. I want to see more of that and how he explores that before he leaves and enters these other titles as a special guest star. But I don't know. I'm cart before the horse here. It's probably fine. Let's talk about another event. Justice League Dream Girls, a DC Pride event, number 3 from DC Comics, written by Nicole Maines and Jadzia Axelrod and G. Willow Wilson. Art by Branton Stein, Jan Basaldúa, Rosie Kemp, and Maria Lovett. In the front story, Dreamer and Galaxy are dealing with two things. One, in the dream world, the Key is trying to get some info out of Dreamer, while in the real world, Galaxy is maybe going to be kicked out of the Justice League. They're both very messily dealing with that, and there is a backup story about what else? Poison Ivy and Harley Quinn from G. Willow Wilson and Maria Lovett. This is great. I've said this every issue, but I love this event. You know, I was thinking about something we were talking about on our Patreon Discord, I want to say a month or two ago. It doesn't really matter. But we were talking about how gay characters aren't allowed to be messy the way that straight characters are often in comics.
Yeah.
Dreamer and Galaxy are a mess. Like, self-admitted, complete, utter mess. And they are using that. And Jadzia Axelrod and Nicole Maines are so expertly using that to allow them to grow, which is something that you don't actually see from mainstream comic book characters a lot. It's great. I love the action. I love the story. And I thought the backup story was great as well. What a great use of Maria Lovett in particular.
I love the backup. It's so good. The art's awesome. And then, like you're saying about the main story, like, we get to, I feel like in a lot of these events, the Pride events, but sort of all the events, you get, you know, you're in character, and then it's like, then you're bopping around the DC or Marvel universe for a while. But the POV stays so strongly on Galaxy and Dreamer in this, and it's both when they're encountering the larger Justice League, where it's fun, funny, and, like, all over the place. And then these great, like, just smaller scenes where we get to see Galaxy really have a conversation and affect a character and be affected by a character. And then it all sort of comes back to the main action. It's just very well done. And Dreamer continues to be, like, one of the main characters of the DC universe, it feels like. And that's really surprising and good.
Yep. What If Thor, number one from Marvel, written by Torin Grønbæk, art by Sergio De Villa. What If Thor, indeed. We talked to Torin about this on bonus episode of the podcast a couple of weeks back, so go and listen to that. But this is part of the 50th anniversary celebration of What If. And here the idea is, what if during Secret Wars, the original one, Thor got the symbiote instead of Spider-Man, and we see what happens off of that. Basically, what happens is the whole King in Black thing happens much quicker.
Yeah, we get right to some null stuff.
Cut out all the nonsense in the middle.
Yeah, there's a lot of, we don't need a bunch of other symbiotes. We're light on goops in this. We get right to the goop boss very quickly. There's a lot of making fun of Null's name in this for what it means in Norse tongue.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
I guess. So, but then, I thought we were going to get the last one of these what ifs was like a real bummer ending. That was the Phoenix one. Or what if Scott Summers had stayed with Madeline rather than getting back
to I want to mention, I know I wasn't on for that show. Gonna guess Pete hated it because he doesn't like What Ifs. This is my absolute favorite thing about What Ifs, that issue where it was like, what if Madeline Pryor stayed with Scott Summers, which is like a very simple idea, and the end is like the world exploded.
World died. We barely dodged a bullet.
Like, that is a great what if thing where it's like, well, it's this minor thing, and then everybody died.
Yeah.
Very fun.
I agree with you, and honestly, that set me up to expect this to have some big gravity response here. And it's mostly Thor's like, awesome. And then he divorces the symbiote. The symbiote technically sacrifices itself for Thor in a cool scene. So I like that. But then Thor's like, I'm Thor again. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah, it's just a little simpler than the other one. And I like the story. The art is good in here. It's a fun issue. But just personal preference, my mode for What If is something very simple. Like, what if the thing ate toast this morning instead of pancakes? And then by the end, the galaxy is turned into a black hole.
Yeah. It was interesting the way that Thor and the symbiote, the Venom symbiote, just really like palled around. They became the much better co-workers 100%. Than Spider-Man and Venom.
Also, good redesign. We were talking about this a little bit with Torin, whether he was going to get like a little hammer instead of a spider, but I think they made a better choice in here.
Well, I think the symbiote did what it did with Spider-Man. It was like, I'll dress like you, your little Thor.
Yes, outfit. And also, I mean, it's a little anachronistic, but there's a very funny section in here where Loki and Sif are teasing Thor about his new costume. That was very funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all.
Good stuff.
All right, Hellboy in Love Obsidian, number one from Dark Horse Comics, written by Mike Mignola and Christopher Golden, art by Alex Nieto. This is following Hellboy and the woman he has been dating as first they go to a nude beach. Don't worry, Hellboy's not nude. And then they fight some tiny, gross spiders.
Here's what's fucked up. He should have been nude.
100%.
What's he afraid of?
Yeah. Well, he explains it in the issue, but I don't think it was a good explanation.
I agree. And, like, she's very nice about it because they're in love. But I'm like, bro, you're used to sticking out. Let's go.
Yeah, I want to see that hell butt. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, exactly.
Do you know what I'm talking about? Do I need to explain that further?
I guess I know most of what you're talking about. Because you think his butt has little horns?
Yeah, I think so. And he had to shave them down. Also, like, one of the characters in this issue says something about, like, do you think supernatural stuff exists with Hellboy sitting in the backseat of the car? That's a little weird. I feel like we've passed the Rubicon with that once Hellboy shows up.
But I do think, like, Hellboy has, he's moved into, like, sitcom logic where everyone's like, hey, what's up? You're the scientist and scientist's boyfriend? Okay, come on, we're just going to go look around. Like, there's no one's like, what the?
Yeah.
And
I don't know, I feel like there should be a little bit of it. Like, what do they think? He has a weird skin condition that made one of his arms very large and look like stone? I don't know.
It just raises questions. It does, but I like that they move past it. And let me say, I've been a little bit hard on these Hellboy stories where I'm like, let's get to some actual stuff. But I find these Hellboy and love stories, especially this one, very sweet. I like the relationship so much. We get the dialogue with them is very like Before Sunrise, the movie, the awesome trilogy of movies. They're like talking about love, talking about being in love while also doing their job, and it's just like a hang with a fun couple.
Like I had the same reaction reading this issue that it could have almost been a little more concrete, where I was having such a delightful time with them on the nude beach, just hanging out, going on vacation, chatting with each other, that when the gross little spiders came in with the human faces, I was like, aw, no, come on, I was having a nice time.
I do. That was well done, though, I thought, tension-wise. You ever been to a nude beach?
I have not. Have you?
I have been.
Any further details? Or
There were a lot of details. almost exclusively details. Oh. It's a weird vibe because you're like, we're all cool here, but it's like nobody's making a big deal out of anything, right? Everybody?
All checking in with each other.
But there's it's not cool to check in. You got to check out. But it's also, unless you're a regular, it's sort of like, it's hard not to check in. I'm here at this situation.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Let's do a podcast from a nude beach. I think that would be
interesting. Audio only.
Yes, audio nude beach. Absolute Flash, number 16 from DC Comics.
Absolute Flash, that's what you do at a nude beach.
Written by Jeff Lemire, art by Haining. In this issue, we are following up on Grodd and Papa Grodd are on the loose. Also, the Flash finally gets a name, which is the Flash. You knew that, but he didn't know that yet.
He didn't know that.
Obviously, we're in the tank for Absolute Batman and Absolute Green Arrow at this point. How are you feeling about Absolute Flash?
This book does weirdly feel like it is the pushing the larger story. It's doing the thing that DC's done for decades now, where a character will be like, look at this, and it's a piece of paper that says like, what is the Omega stuff or whatever.
Yeah,
and we get that here, and it does feel like Flash is going to be the character that somehow is the catalyst for the next larger move in the Absolute universe. So that's cool. It makes me want to read this more. I also, like, this one has settled in to become the most, like, superhero-y of the Absolutes, with still some nice changes from regular Flash continuity.
Didn't we, this is a little off-topic, but talking about the, like, notes that mean things, didn't we do an interview series with Dan DiDio in front of a whiteboard that had a bunch of clues on it for Newsarama? Am I remembering that wrong?
Yes. And I was like, you know, the one in the comic feels like very meticulously made, thought over. The one in Dan's office, I feel like, I don't know, I'd be very, very curious to carbon date the dry erase marker when it hit that board. Was it 10 minutes before we got there? 30? 4 seconds?
Yeah. Who knows? We'd have to go back in time like the Flash. I also really enjoy this. This is not necessarily my top of the list for the Absolute books, but it's just a really solid, very different Flash book. I like how it's developing, and this Grodd stuff is interesting. Uncanny X-Men, number 30 from Marvel, written by Gail Simone, art by Roger Antonio. This issue, a bunch of stuff going on with the X-Men down in New Orleans as the cover says Mars needs mutants, but we are getting some weird aliens or something. We don't exactly know what's going on here attacking them as they go about their day. It is maybe prom, definitely some sort of formal dance happening at the high school, and the kids need the adults to help them pick out corsages and take them to their dates, which is very cute. Meanwhile, we're dealing with the fallout of the falling down of Grey Malkin Prison. Monet is in charge now and trying to find out what the prison was really about, as well as quelling the prisoners from rebelling. So lots of stuff being juggled in this issue, but I gotta say, this continues to be my absolute favorite of the X-Men line. It just really, there is a lot going on, but it keeps it well-balanced throughout this issue, and all of the individual storylines are really interesting. I also think, like, that arc we had previously where the kids were taken back and put into, like, a dream state, an AI dream state of the old professor's mansion, really just, like, focused in on who these new Outliers characters actually are, spent some time with them. So this is great. It's funny. There's some great romantic stuff happening with Nightcrawler. I'm really enjoying this.
The Nightcrawler romance is transcending all of the X-Men universe. It feels like everyone's like, this guy's in love. It's nice. And everyone wants to have a little scene of him doing that.
Yeah.
In all the books. And that's sweet. You can just tell what affection everybody has for Nightcrawler. I also like this. I would argue, though, there's just as much going on in this issue as there is in Absolute Batman. But you're not mad at this issue.
No.
Interesting. Interesting.
It's because of the pattern that this book is set up. It's always been dealing with a lot of stuff. And sometimes, particularly in the early going, it felt a little jumbled and hard to hold on to. There'd be individual scenes or things that I could pull out. But it, the past couple of arcs, like I've been talking about, I think it just like, it focused in, figured out the characters, figured out the right rhythm for this stuff. I do feel like I want to see the stuff with Monet and the stuff with the New Orleans X-Men not be two parallel trades running that never meet. I want to see them come together, and I think they will. But other than that, all of the various scenes, it's giving that soap opera feel that you want from X-Men. And that's the other thing, is that like Batman is a very different thing from X-Men. X-Men, there is an expectation, no pun intended, of jumping around and following all these different things, that it's not just one mission of the week and that's it.
Yeah, and I do like the focus on the younger mutants. The prom stuff's really good. We get to see Gambit and Wolverine being funny there. I love Monet. Like, the fact that we get to see her, when she was introduced in Generation X so long ago, I was like, this character is such a badass. And she's never really, in that book, she was good. And we got to see a lot of her in Age of Apocalypse, who's very cool, but never really ascend to being like a prime mutant and be a true badass. And this issue is the most of that maybe we've seen in her entire run as a character. Yeah. So love that. Love the idea of seeing more from her going forward. And then the Mars Needs Mutants. Is this an Oroko?
A what?
Storyline? The Mars. Is it Oroko? The
Oroko? No, Oroko. I think that's just like they're making a joke about Mars Needs. What's it called? I'm forgetting what the actual title of the movie is.
Moms.
There's Moms, yes. I mean, we get the Brood in here. I don't think it's actually the Brood, since they're holding guns, which is weird for the Brood. So maybe there's more AI stuff going on. Maybe there's something else. I'm not sure. But we'll see. Maybe.
We shall see.
Invincible Universe Battle Beast, number 10 from Skybound and Image Comics, written by Robert Kirkman, art by Ryan Ottley. Last issue, Conquest arrived on the planet that Battle Beast is currently making his home, at least temporarily. This issue, as you all demanded, they sit down to dinner together. But don't worry, they also fight and start to wreck the planet at the same time. You know, we talk a lot about different Robert Kirkman books. There has been, not to keep bringing up our Patreon Discord, but a lot of talk about Void Rivals and his stuff in the Energon universe in particular. And I agree that that can be a little jumbled and hard to follow sometimes, including, frankly, Transformers.
Yeah.
This is just, you can tell the fun that he's having. Like, it's light, it's very fluffy, there's not too much going on here. You know what you're getting, but I'm having a good time reading this book.
Well, this was my favorite issue of this whole series. Like, it's really,
okay.
It really crystallizes here, where you're like, these two are like at odds from the second you read the first page. The art's big and bold. All the other characters there are like, these two dudes are going to kill each other. The same thing we're thinking. And it takes a while to get to it. And then they have an awesome fight where they're both posturing, going against Todd McFarlane's advice in our live show from yesterday, where these characters are spouting action movie lines back to back to back, saying being the biggest badass of all. But it makes for a good fight. There's a lot of great turnarounds in this. It's crazy that I was complaining about this in the last issue, where I'm like, we know what happens with these characters. They both live until they fight next to each other, without referencing this situation, obviously, in the Invincible War. But it's still, I was still caught up in it. I wasn't feeling the plot armor on them at all in this.
Yeah. Great stuff. Fun issue. New Titans, number 36 from DC Comics, written by Tate Bromble, art by Marcus Toe. Now, in the first arc of this series, the regular Titans had been captured by an evil version of Cyborg, and some new Titans were brought in to rescue them. Now they're all living together in Titans Mountain and trying to figure out what that means, the new team, as well as some new characters that have been introduced. We, I believe, love the first arc of this, not exactly new series, but this iteration of Titans. How do you feel about it kicking into arc number two?
These are my favorite types of issues in comics, especially big team comics, where they're like, we're trying to figure out who's on the team. They're all just like catching up with each other. Some characters are sort of eliminated from it, where we get a nice scene here. With Starfire and Nightwing. Other characters feel like, yes, Batgirl's going to be a badass part of this. I'm so hyped for that. Like, there's just like, it's that rare issue in comics where you can feel a lot of shifts happening and it feels like it's going to be at least semi-permanent. Mm-hmm. And that's what we get here. As well as the interesting stuff going on with Cyborg and Eva, I thought was very cool as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is great. I love this. And what I love about this is how they're playing with classic Titans storylines in a new way. Like the first arc, I think they explicitly said at one point, oh no, an evil Cyborg is a grid. And they're like, no, it's a different thing, but it's kind of the same thing, but in a new way. And this issue, we get the absolute terrifying reveal of, at the seaside town, there's just an enormous demon that seems to be eating babies, and then there's more than that. And I think they're doing like a riff on a classic Trigon storyline, but without Trigon, and again in an entirely new way. And I love that. Like, I love giving us this thing that we know, but through the lens of these new Titans. There's ongoing mysteries with Cyborg has the heart of Apocalypse in the middle of the mountain, which is crazy.
Yes, very cool.
So I said this the last issue, that it took me too long to realize that this is basically them doing Uncanny X-Men back from the beginning, but with Titans. But all of these elements are working. It's just, it's great. It's fun. I'm having a good time.
Well, and this was reminding me of what I've been missing by not having a Legion or Legionnaires title, which is also something we've been talking about recently on the podcast.
Next up, The Spectacular Spider-Man, Brand New Day, number 2 from Marvel, written by Dan Slott, art by Marcus Toe. Once again, this is a maybe mini-series. When we had Dan Slott on the live show, he was like, keep buying it, and it'll become an ongoing series. But this is the second of our two not exactly tying into Spider-Man Brand New Day books, because Punisher is in it, and maybe Mr. Negative is in the movie, but I'm not 100% sure. Spider-Man is, for sure.
How do you feel about this cover?
That's a big gun that the Punisher has in a very specific place.
It's very much
his crotch.
It's a very much a crotch gun from Dusk Till Dawn situation here, except on a much larger scale. And especially the way the cover is laid out, where it's like a circle, which is even more emphasizing the phallus that the Punisher and Spider-Man's looking. Not at us and not at Punisher. He's looking at the gun like, hey, man, this isn't a nude beach. Put that thing away. very strange cover, I find. But the internal issue, as I was reading this, and I mentioned this to you before, like, I'm like, are some of these elements what's going to be in the Spider-Man movie? Like, are we going to get a Mr. Negative
I don't think
you
so.
You say hard no, but some of, I feel like sometimes, a lot of times they are about comic continuity, but this one's not really about comic continuity at all. It's about the characters. And I'm like, are there movie elements here not used the same way as the movie, obviously, but laid out a little bit? Are we going to get Mr. Negative somehow driving John Bernthal in the brand new day movie?
Maybe, possibly. I don't know. I look at this more like Dan Slott's way of retconning a bunch of stuff into the continuity of Brand New Day. Like, this is the second issue in a row that we've had, what's his name, Bailey Bass, Spider-Boy, show up in the book, so that, like, of course he was there all along. There's a couple of other characters. It looked like maybe Silk was in there as well, potentially, but maybe I'm wrong about that. I don't know. Whatever it is, it's just Dan Slott having a lot of fun with Spider-Man and going forward. It's very light. It's fun. It is what it is. I don't think you should be looking at it for movie clues, but we'll know in a month.
So we'll see, Alex. Will the Punisher have a big old dick gun in the movie?
Gosh, I hope so. Yeah. R-rated, first R-rated Spider-Man movie. That's what we're going to get. Babs, The Black Road South, number 4 from Ahoy Comics, written by Garth Ennis, art by Jason Burrows. This arc of the title has very much been a parody of Lord of the Rings, as our heroes, I guess, find themselves heading towards Mordor, dealing with a one ring, except it's an orb type situation. And there's a one remaining hobbit, who I believe is our Sam, who is now wearing a gip suit and wants to kill them. Find out a lot more about that, about as well as why this issue. I think you've been enjoying this more than I have, Justin.
Well, I do like it. I mean, first off, not to be a Pete here, but the cover of this is awesome. I kept re-looking at the cover. If you haven't seen it, it's Babs with a snake corpse pulling her her cohort, her peer, out of the snake's dead insides, which is very good. And then this story does a great job of balancing some pretty hard parody with, like, the emotional reality that Babs is, like, maybe confessing to being a bad person or formerly a bad warrior within the context of this story about a Sam who was confessing his love for his Frodo right when Babs knocked him into Mount Doom.
Yeah. I think, not to get too repetitious with this book, it's fine. Like, if you like Garth Ennis stuff, which I generally do, and if you like Jason Burrows, which I generally do, this is straight across the plate, profane, gross. But like you're saying, there is some good emotional stuff in there as well. It's just the first series was so good and so sharp with its satire. I continue to miss that versus being like, this being like the Hobbit movie instead of scary movie, if you will.
It's leaned a little bit harder into the story, the Babs story, and out of the satire and parody elements. And maybe that's, you're saying that's a betrayal.
Definitely like a strongest of all possible betrayals, 100%. Yes.
Great. Yeah.
Well, I feel betrayed.
You have
I'm giving up comics. If Destruction Be Our Lot, number 2 from Image Comics, written by Matthew and Mark Elijah Rosenberg, art by Andy McDonald. We are following a robot Abe Lincoln in a far future where it seems like all humans have disappeared, except, of course, they haven't. And he is headed to the scrap heap this issue because he is having what is society, robot society, considers some malfunctions. Justin, you've been loving this book, right? Yes?
I have been. Big fan. I think this issue continues a lot of the promise that we got in the first issue. We get Lincoln realizing, or we're being told that he's very special, which I think is, but he's not really taking it in. He's just tumbling C-3PO style. Through a bunch of, right?
Here's not to interrupt you, but
I got Matthew, you though. I got
Matthew you. Rosenberg, his newsletter, every iteration of his newsletter, whatever he sends it out, the subject line is a quote from C-3PO. And I didn't notice it in the first issue. This issue, it is crazy out of control. Like, he is 100% in a C-3PO situation. You're right. He says C-3PO lines throughout here where I didn't mind it. Like, I love this book. The art is gorgeous and everything, but it was a little distracting for me being like, what? Why?
Well, it wouldn't have been such a thing except there he keeps tumbling through, like, the droid wrecking spots that we see so many times throughout the Star Wars canon. From the Jawa ship, like, we're in those same situations, and he's being like, what is this place? Whoa!
Yeah. A lot. Well, but he keeps saying things. I'm forgetting the exact lines, but he's like, oh, dear, at one point, which I was like, that's not Abraham.
Never tell me the C-3PO. Odds. I think he says over and over again.
Yeah, he says something about midi-chlorians as well, I believe.
But I do think, like, that doesn't bother me maybe as much as you. I think it's a protagonist finding, like, over this first few issues, finding his sort of juice, finding his power. And he doesn't have it yet. He's not aware of the world. The call to action is happened a little bit, and then it happens again by accident, but he hasn't made the choice yet. So I think we're going to get to see a little bit more agency, a little less C-3PO, and a little more R2-D2.
Yeah. Do you think, I was about to ask, do you think Mary Todd Lincoln is like Abraham Lincoln's R2-D2?
In real life?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. They were always appearing in every part of American history. They're the only consistent thing in American history.
And John Wilkes Booth is kind of like that stormtrooper who blasts C-3PO in Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah. And I believe his last words were like, oh dear, please find my torso, you big pile of hair, or whatever his quote is.
We've seen these movies before, I'm sure. Lobo, number 4 from DC Comics, written by Scotty Young, art by Jorge Corona, in a bit of actual movie tie-in, because Scotty Young told us as much when he was on the live show.
Yeah.
Lobo faces down with Supergirl in this issue. This, if anything, I mean, it's not exactly tying into the movie, but I think they do a pretty good job of being like, hey, if you saw the movie and you want to see Lobo and Supergirl fight, here you go.
And this is definitely feels like it's in line with at least the vibe of the movie, if not the storyline. And I was surprised how late in the comic Supergirl comes in. It's past the halfway point. But the thing that was awesome here is Jorge Corona's art. Like, when Supergirl shows up, it's such just the art's fantastic. Crypto. Lobo and his dog, like, that kind of stuff is fun. We get the comedic push through in the back half where you see them being like, oh no, is well done. And this book just continues to be such a high octane version of Lobo that I think is the best presentation of the character.
Predator Bloodshed, number 5 from Marvel, written by Jordan Morris, art by Ruari Coleman with Roland Boski. This is the final issue of the series that has found a bunch of souped-up Mortal Kombat-style MMA fighters taking on a Predator. We also had Jordan Morris on the show a couple of months back to talk about this, so check that out. But this is very fun. Really liked the conclusion here. Left it open for more as well, but well-etched characters throughout is the thing that really set this apart. These are fighters that I wanted to spend more time with, and hopefully we will get to do exactly that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a moment where one of the fighters, who's not our main character, our main duo, is like, I'll take the Predator. And I really was riding for her fight with the Predator.
Yeah.
I really liked that character. She seemed fun and sort of like, bit of a rogue, like, I'll do this. And then she gets so unceremoniously killed. I was definitely bummed at that moment.
Yeah. This is a very fun series. If you missed it, definitely go back, pick up the issues, or pick it up in trade. Odin, number 2 from Image Comics, written by Marguerite Bennett and James Todd IV, art by Letizia Catanici. This is about a journalist who is undercover with a bunch of neo-Nazis who decide to take a trip to the fatherland, not Germany, but Norway, where they believe all whiteness comes from. And the oopsie at the end of the last issue is they all got high and ate one of their friends. So that's where we pick up here with them wrestling with, oh no, we did a cannibalism, and things somehow get worse by the end of the issue.
This is a stressful read.
Yes.
I like it. But it's definitely like, oh no, another. And then we get a really big horror moment. And what is cool about this, something you don't see very often, is sort of a double hit of the horror. We get like the visionary version of it, and then we get the like not fucked up version of it, and it's still fucked up. That's a well done.
And I think the other thing that's stressful about it is you don't know who to ride with. Like, technically, it should be this journalist. Yeah. But there's multiple points in this issue in particular, I think very pointedly, where she's like, I should escape. Except maybe. And you're like, oh, come on, man. Yeah. You maybe like this a little bit or into this or some, finding it a little engrossing.
There's something about the sort of leader and the mystery of him that keeps drawing our main character in and draws us as the reader in, because he is in a place that feels like hell. He's like confidently standing and just observing, standing still and observing everyone and everything. And that's, it's well done. I'm curious. I just don't know at all where the story's going.
Yeah, agreed. Star Trek, The Last Starship, number 8 from IDW, written by Colin Kelly and Jackson Lansing, art by Herman Gonzalez. In this issue, last issue, I think you said that they kind of entered an event horizon type situation, and that's what they're dealing with partially the fallout of here, as Agnes, the Borg Queen, tries to assimilate everybody on the ship. Meanwhile, they're dealing with a bunch of other stuff, and Captain Kirk, who is made of nanites, is trying to stop her from destroying everybody, leading to yet another big cliffhanger at the end of this issue. How are you feeling about this title?
It's scary. It's so psychedelic, fucked up stuff happening. When we first started reading this, and we talked to these guys about this, and they were like, "Where do you see? We're doing so much." And I was like, "Yeah, okay. It's like a Kirk-focused story in this place where they're so unexplored." But I just can't believe how much like is jammed in here that feels so metaphysically horrifying and very like mind bending. There's a lot of like physical psychic pressure on the characters that is like making them all feel so crazy. And I mean, just like, I'm like, what is happen? What's going to happen here? Like, what is anyone going to walk out of here and be on the next Enterprise and be like, all right, let's go explore some fucking space now.
Yeah, I don't think so. And my one little like quibble here is that there's not even so many characters, but I feel like they keep giving us a new point of view character who I need to take a second and be like, who is that? What's going on with that person? And by the end, I'm into them, but then they're usually dead by the end of the issue. So it's hard. It's a little hard to get invested with these characters other than Agnes, who I know from Star Trek Picard, and Kirk, who we know from being Captain Kirk.
Yeah, we know from our time with Captain Kirk. But also, it's just, it reminds me of how the Lost scripts were written, where, like, and this isn't a roast, just a reality, where there's this character who has a dark secret, and then the last panel is like, yeah, they're a motherfucking bomb inside. And I was like, what?
It's pretty crazy. It's a crazy Star Trek book. There you go. Deathstroke, the Terminator, number 4 from DC Comics, written by Tony Fleece, art by Carmine Di Giandomenico. Deathstroke has been accused of the murder of his best friend, Wintergreen, and this issue, Rose Wilson, a.k.a. Ravager, his daughter, comes to first watch him die and then team up with him and then maybe some other stuff by the end of this issue. Another great issue of this title. I really like focusing in on the relationship between Slade and Rose, the differences between them. Carmine Di Giandomenico's art continues to be really good. This is a defining Deathstroke story.
It really is. Like, it's so good. And in this stack alone, let alone all the other comics we read, we see a lot of, like, people get murdered for what some people think are the right reasons, heroes, villains. There's a murder in this issue that I was, like, really upset by. Mm-hmm. Even though the character is being a huge asshole and probably a criminal monster. But even so, the way that Deathstroke kills him, I was like, I don't think you're supposed to do that from a hero or even mercenary point of view.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's really well plotted, and it is really pushing those things, because it would be easy to go the route of like, well, Deathstroke's a hero. And he's not. He's not a hero at all. And that's what we're driving home. But there's also a moderation between hero and villain that we don't usually get in these sort of titles. It's usually one or the other.
And, like, I think we've gotten him trending toward hero. Like, I have to solve this murder. I'll kill people my way. But even, like, the last issue, he didn't kill a bunch of people. He was just fighting for his life. Mm-hmm. And in this issue, the killing feels like he needed to do it. He wanted to do it, needed to do it. And the guy was just being a gross monster in this moment. And then we see, not only do we see him go to kill him, we see the corpse, and then Rose finds out about it. And I thought that was just a great scene as well.
Yeah, well done. G.I. Joe, number 23 from Skybound at Image Comics, written by Joshua Williamson, art by Andrea Milana. The Joes and the Cobras are both being tortured by Crystal Ball, guy who has some sort of Energon-powered fear machine or something like that. We talked to Joshua Williamson recently about this book and many others. Not to keep plugging our podcast on our podcast, but you can check out that chat for more. This is a very fun arc. I think Andrea Milana, Andrea Milana and Joshua Williamson obviously know how to work together really well. So they're well coordinated. And we find out a little bit more about Risk, who is a new character for this book, who is very intriguing too.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I don't, there's a lot of focus on Risk, and I was like, this is where I need Pete here to be like, Risk's really important. Or I don't know about Risk either. What's the deal with Risk? And I'd be like, that's what I think. Risk feels like he's becoming important, but I don't know necessarily why in the larger story. But the art in this is excellent. Like, all of the crystal ball, and this is what Joshua was talking about. Like, I wanted to make him a big deal and make him be like a fucked up villain, something that he's weird, but you can still tell a good story about him. And I think he's doing a great job for that.
Yeah, absolutely. End of Life, number 5 from DC Comics, written by Kyle Starks, art by Steve Pugh. We are following a dude who is an assassin who has gone back to his hometown. And the noose is really tightening on him here as our old cartoonist who has become a gang leader has taken the one kid in town that means anything to him. And he's basically browbeat into getting the kid back. Meanwhile, his dad, who we thought was killed, or at least I was pretty convinced was killed last issue, is not dead. And happy. They are, and they are moving forward on their relationship too. This is great. I think this, maybe I'd have to look down the list, but maybe this is my favorite of the Vertigo titles right now. It's funny. It's hitting that. Maybe we mentioned this before, but it really feels like the heir to Preacher more than anything, though it's not as supernatural, but it's absolutely ridiculous. There's some really good texture to the emotion that's happening with the main character and his dad, which I found very surprising in this issue in particular. And all of the villains are weird and horrible and very fun as well.
Yeah, I agree. There's this great sequence at the back end where he's being attacked. And then a bunch of the henchmen get shot. And the villain's like, he's got mind bullets. And he's like, I have mind bullets? And then they believe it for another page. And then like, no, he's got a sniper backing him up, you idiots. It just reminded me of that scene in The Jerk where it's like, these cans, he hates these cans. And I sort of bet that's what Kyle was drawing from here. Mm-hmm. And it's really fun.
Of the Earth, number 2 from Image Comics, written by Chris Condon and Andrew Eric, art by Charlie Adlard. The last issue, a woman came home to visit her grandmother, who lives in the middle of some oil fields, and found her hunkered in the basement, covered in oil. This issue, she calls the oil company, is like, hey, what's going on here? My grandma, grandma's covered in oil. And they send a guy to help out, and things get even weirder by the end. I was intrigued by the first issue, and I also always like everything that Chris Condon puts out. But, man, it gets real good, this issue, and even more intriguing. The mysteries are strange and disturbing. Charlie Adlard's art is great. This is a good book.
Yeah, the pace of this is so well done. It's so, like, horror... horror pacing where like, oh yeah, call the company, no problem. Sort of normal interaction, but just a little odd. And then they're like, oh yeah, and there's a truck here. That's weird. Oh, there's a weird that there's a truck here. Like, we keep getting these little bits and pieces where you're like, that's a little weird. And it sticks in our brain and just starts to stress us out a little bit. And that's humming along. And then the stress is increased to we get full of horror by the end of it here. The art is really backing up the oil, the mm-hmm. amount of oil we see in here. And that being the supernatural, this is a guess, the supernatural thing we're dealing with. So yeah, I like this. I'm in, and maybe I'm on a horror streak like everyone else in America with all the success at the box office, but this is hitting for me.
Superman Unlimited, number 14 from DC Comics, written by Dan Slott, art by Lucas Meyer and Dan Messina. Now, John Kent seemingly has been taken from the past. Meanwhile, the older version of John Kent is pretending to be somebody named Tomorrow Man to make space for his younger version. But we get a big revelation at the end of this issue that I thought was great. They have this mystery of John doesn't seem to be working exactly how you would expect. Yeah. I personally couldn't necessarily figure it out, so I was surprised by the reveal here, but it makes total sense, and I thought it was really well done for the history of John Kent in particular, so good issue.
Yeah, and I really like that Lois is trying to figure it out mm-hmm. sort of at the same time, and we get that in a very emotional way, talking to Mon Pa Kent, and so like the end hits so much harder with that, giving a little bit of basis, like emotional basis for the reveal as well.
Redcoat, number 18 from Ghost Machine and Image Comics, written by Jeff Johns, art by Brian Hitch. Our titular Redcoat, Simon Pure, has a family and is trying to be a normal guy, but of course he can't because he's actually immortal, which all comes crashing down this issue. Justin, this has been one of your favorite books for a while. What'd you think about this issue?
I think it's really good. We get an emotional confession from Redcoat. He's settled into a life where he has a wife and a family. And he's like, I'm immortal and I live these ways. And man, is his wife not having it. And I was like, oh, that's a little, I was surprised at that reaction. I think story-wise, it makes sense and it is setting something up. I think it's setting two things up. One, I think the next arc is like he wants to not be immortal anymore. Mm-hmm. Because he's sad, I'm assuming because his wife and family left. But secondarily, the wife's like, if you really love us, come find us. No clues. I'm like, right. Man, that's some old-fashioned fucked up shit right
leave
there.
One clue.
I would leave a clue. Yeah. If you really want to be found, you got to leave a clue.
Yeah, you leave a postcard in the fireplace or something like that.
Unless she's like, well, I went to my uncle's because that's where I go.
Come find us. We're upstairs.
Yeah, exactly. It's a real short term. I love a little play like that. A little like, yeah. Hey, come find me.
I was just thinking with this issue, it's kind of crazy that Brian Hitch has managed to pump out 18 monthly, pretty much, issues of this Redcoat book, which is wild. I was thinking about, it was Ultimates, right? That was delayed years, if I remember correctly.
I remember we interviewed Brian Hitch sort of at the tail end. He's like, I did it. I was like, holy shit, this guy's been stressed for a long time about this.
Yeah, so it's a treat. His art is just so good, so detailed. Every action scene he does is great. So getting at this regularly is pretty wonderful.
Yes.
Last but not least, Smile for the Camera, number 4 from IDW, written by Hada Rose May, art by Mariana Puglia. We are following a bunch of fashion models who have been infected by the Smile entity. And there's only 2 of them left this issue, so you know what's going to go down in the final issue. This has been really building nicely, I think. It has been well observed about the fashion industry, working in the whole Smile thing. But this is my favorite issue of this so far. I thought it really just focused in very nicely on the Smile stuff, and it was cool and scary and good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised how caught up I am in the lives of these models who are... They're trapped in this scheme where they have to pay for their like hotel accommodations. And I'm like, that doesn't seem real, but I still really hate that they're stuck doing it. Mm-hmm. So it's working on me. And I haven't watched the Smile movies, and I know they're good. and I know I should watch them.
Second one is good. Yeah.
I don't quite know how it's spread, but I'm really worried about our main character here.
Yeah. You should definitely be worried for sure. I will mention that today or this week, they announced they're doing another one, which is based on the world of football, called Any Given Smile, which is pretty funny.
That's crazy.
Yeah, which is great. So bring on more. I think they're doing a great job with these so far. Yeah. And that is it for the stack. If you'd like to support this podcast and all the podcasts we do, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to YouTube. Come hang out. We would love to chat with you about comic books. Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice to subscribe, listen, and follow the show. Comicbookclublive.com. For this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
And as always, remember, any beach can be a nude beach if you take your pants off. Good night.
And they left the secrets leak. And occasionally they